Most of us think of YouTube as a place where you spend a few minutes, get a few laughs, and encounter the unexpected.
Mishka, I love you. Mishka, I love you. Mishka, I love you.
I love you. I love you.
I love you.
Good girl.
I love you.
I love you. Good girl. Good girl. I love you. Say I love you.
Memorable. But YouTube may be changing, and in a big way. These days, our internet watching experiences are very different from our TV viewing. We'll enjoy short, grainy videos on computers, but spend hours in the living room with the TV set. As technology changes in coming years, though, TV sets will offer internet content just as easily as cable or broadcast TV. And internet content providers like YouTube can compete for big audiences and big advertising dollars. So YouTube, which is owned by Google, is preparing to launch dozens of professionally produced channels with specialized content they hope will appeal to millions of people. John Seabrook writes about YouTube's ambitious plans in the current issue of The New Yorker. John Seabrook is a staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest book is Flash of Genius and Other True Stories of Invention. Well, John Seabrook, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thanks, Dave.
You know, a long time ago, there were, you know, the three major networks which could produce television, which got a huge national audience. And then cable came along and fragmented, you know, the TV viewing audience. And we also saw, you know, more narrowly focused channels, food channels, a history channel, shopping channels, you know, fishing channels. Does YouTube think there's a market for even narrower niches?
Yes, they definitely do. I mean, they see the Asian channel, for example, which there doesn't really exist on cable, or an Asian sitcom, or a transgender channel, or a, well, a cricket channel, or a horseback riding channel. There are a lot of sports and pastimes that have a large group of people interested in them, but they're not necessarily based in one country. And one of the unique things about YouTube is that it's global, so you can put together an audience of cricket lovers from many countries around the world and achieve a pretty large audience. But if you just tried to do that in one country, you'd get a fairly small audience. So YouTube allows you to kind of aggregate these disparate audiences in various countries and put them together into one pretty good-sized chunk.
Right. And they're going to be, you know, commissioning, you know, professional performers or content developers to make stuff for them. Who are they asking to produce channels?
Well, you know, over the last year, they've held kind of a sweepstakes. The word went out. It was an open secret. YouTube wouldn't confirm it officially, but a lot of people got approached by YouTube in many different media, print, TV, movies, music, dance. And YouTube offered kind of book publishing style advances of several million dollars to people who were professional content creators who were willing to make content for one of these new YouTube channels. And they got something like 1,000 people who submitted proposals for channels, and then they winnowed it down to about 100. A lot of them are people you know. I mean, Madonna's doing a dance-oriented channel. Shaquille O'Neal is doing a kind of, I don't know, Shaq kind of comedy channel. There's some writers of well-known TV shows. For example, Anthony Zecker, who created CSI for CBS, is doing a sort of night gallery-like show. Amy Poehler is doing a channel. So there are quite a few sort of celebrities from the old world that we already know. And then there are some of these YouTube partners, sort of homegrown stars, like Michelle Phan, who has a very popular beauty tips channel, who have gotten one of these advances in order to sort of, you know, have the money to create bigger production values and more elaborate scenarios.
Now, in terms of advertising, we're used to seeing TV peppered with like 30 and 60 second ads on the computer. YouTube, we're used to pop-up ads. What kind of advertising will appear on YouTube channels, or is that clear yet?
Well, it's not really clear yet. I mean, YouTube would love to get you know, 30-second or 60-second long ads that people would watch. I mean, the big difference is, I think, that you're going to always have the option to click away from the ad on YouTube after a certain amount of time. And there, the proposition to the advertisers is, well, yes, it's true that we're not forcing people to watch your ads the way we are on television, but when people don't click away, you know that those people are very motivated, you know, potential customers. Also, we know their information. Because this is all delivered over the internet, you know a lot more about the people who are watching your ads than you do about the people who are watching your ads on television. You know, you tend to know their history on YouTube, at least. You might know some of their social friends, particularly if they are linking their YouTube stuff to Facebook. And then you can get into their purchase histories and stuff like that. So there's potentially a lot more information and potentially a much more sort of motivated audience. But you do have to get people to watch the ads. And that actually might not be a bad thing either, because it might force people who make ads to really make a great ad, an ad that you just really want to watch. And particularly the first 10 seconds of that ad, which is that part that you're going to watch before you have a chance to click away. If you can make something really super compelling, you know, that's a win for everyone, because, you know, you get an ad that you like to watch and the advertiser gets you. In fact, the most viral of all videos, the quickest video to a million views on YouTube, is the Old Spice. It's an ad. It's that guy, that Old Spice guy, doing his thing. And I think this is another thing when we look forward. I think the distinction between advertising and programming is probably going to get a little blurrier in the YouTube future.
Right. And of course, the fact that advertisers can get all this data about the individuals that are viewing their stuff, as you said, I mean, maybe even who some of their social relationships are, what their viewing habits are, is kind of creepy to some people.
It is kind of creepy. But, you know, it's kind of creepy when you write an email and Google has got ads that are keying on words that you put in your email right next to, you know, your personal email. But, you know, you get used to it and you're willing to make these trade-offs. You get Gmail for free and it's supported by ads. And, you know, you say to yourself, well, you know, hopefully Google is not going to misuse this information. That's the big question. And so you go with it.
I wonder if there's a risk that sort of the essence and appeal of YouTube, I mean, you know, the serendipity of finding a hilarious moment or a unique voice, you know, would be undermined by this whole new direction.
It's a good question. And it's true that one of the pleasures of YouTube, two of the pleasures of YouTube have been, A, the sort of anarchic nature of it, which, you know, in the early days just seemed so great that, you know, you could have this totally unplanned, you know, no one was in charge type feeling. So different from television. And then the other aspect of it was, as you said, the serendipity, the things that you would just stumble upon. And I think as these new channels come in and start getting popular, it's probably going to be less likely that you're going to stumble upon things that are totally out of left field, because, you know, that's just the way that the site is going to be reoriented toward, you know, the hit makers and away from, you know, the random people. They'll still be there, but it's, I think, going to be less easy to find than it has been. And that would be kind of a loss.
Do you have a favorite channel, a favorite performer of yours?
Yeah, I love the Gregory Brothers. I think they're musically really talented. They're great musicians. It's three siblings and the wife of one of the siblings.
Just explain what it is the Gregory Brothers do.
The Gregory Brothers are looking around, actually what happens now is a lot of people send the Gregory Brothers YouTube videos that they have found that they think might work in their format. And if the Gregory Brothers see something they think will work as a sort of a musical piece, they'll take the person's speech, and run it through this machine that auto-tunes it, so, you know, it sort of sounds like it's sung and it has a kind of musical background to it. And then they'll sort of chop it up so that certain key phrases in the Antoine Dawson video, there was one or two phrases that keep coming back, And in the I Love Cats, it's, you know, I love cats, I love every kind of cat, becomes a kind of a chorus. So, you know, in the end, you've got a song, and it's also a fun thing to watch. So it's a sort of a mashup of a video, like a music video, but a music video based on something that didn't begin as a music video. So repurposed. That's the difference.
Well, John Seabrook, it's been interesting. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Dave. Nice to be here again.
Let's listen to I Love Cats.
This is my first attempt at a eHarmony video. I'm nervous, but I'm excited at the same time. So I'm just going to start talking about what I like. I love cats. I love every kind of cat. I just want to hug all of them, but I can't. Can't hug every cat. Can't hug every cat. So anyway, I am a cat lover and I love to run. I'm sorry I'm thinking about cats again. I really love cats. I'm thinking about cats again and again and again and again and again. I think about how many don't have a home and how I should have some. I think about how cute they are and how their ears and the whiskers and the nose.
John Seabrook's piece on YouTube is in the current edition of The New Yorker. You can find some favorite YouTube video pics of the Fresh Air staff on our website, freshair.npr.org.
One topic that's getting scant attention this election season is climate change. Instead, the economy and social issues are front and center, but scientists are working as hard as ever to figure out how much the Earth is warming and what to do about it. Some now say it's time for a new strategy. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, a strategy that gets faster results.
Durwood Zelke is a grizzled veteran of the climate wars. He was in Kyoto in 1997 when the world's nations drafted a treaty promising to curb warming, and he's watched that promise fizzle while the planet's temperature continues to rise. Zelke says the Kyoto Treaty focused too much on the main greenhouse gas, carbon dioxide.
I mean, it's like picking a fight with the biggest bully in the schoolyard. You get your lunch money stolen, you get your pants pulled down, and you get sent home humiliated. We've made about that much progress with CO2.
Most CO2 comes from big power plants and factories, the engines of economic development. Few governments have been willing to endanger development with limits on CO2. Zelke runs the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development in Washington, D.C. He says it's time to look for other climate solutions.
You can't expect one treaty system to address every cause of climate change. It's too complex of a problem.
A growing number of scientists agree. They're focusing less on CO2 and more on other things that warm the planet, especially ozone and black carbon. Black carbon is mostly soot from burning wood, charcoal, and dung. Climate scientist Drew Schindel, with NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies, says ozone and soot live in the air for only a few months or years before they degrade or fall to Earth. If you slow or stop producing them, pretty soon the atmosphere will be fairly soot and ozone free.
So these things really have an immediate and quite powerful, in many cases, effect on climate, both at global and regional scales.
Carbon dioxide, on the other hand, stays in the atmosphere for much longer, so curbing CO2 from smokestacks won't show benefits for many decades. Schindel says cutting ozone and soot could slow warming by half a degree Celsius by 2050.
By averting a half a degree of projected warming, that's really a substantial portion of whether the planet really goes over 2 degrees or stays below that.
2 degrees warmer is when most climate scientists say bad things start happening to the planet. Schindel says there are economic reasons for cutting ozone and soot as well. For example, ozone is created when methane gets into the atmosphere. Methane is essentially natural gas. It escapes from coal mines, livestock waste ponds, and pipelines. It's valuable, and capturing it saves money. Also, ozone damages commercial crops and causes smog. As for soot, it causes respiratory disease and millions of premature deaths.
If you factor in the air quality benefits and their large effects on health, then you find that the reductions are really giving you benefits.
Benefits that outweigh the costs. Shindell bases his calculations on wide-ranging assumptions about global health and economic gains, as well as what it would all cost. The numbers vary widely and are likely to be questioned. But the study does confirm others that say ozone and soot should be added to CO2 on the climate hit list. And climate activist Durwood Zelke says that unlike carbon dioxide, the tools to reduce these pollutants are familiar.
We have laws and we have institutions in most countries that already know something about controlling this. We already know the technology. We already know how to do it.
And it wouldn't take an international treaty to do it either. Shindell's research appears in the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Since the collapse of the domestic steel industry, blue-collar workers in the mountain towns near the border of Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio have been struggling to find jobs. Last June, Shell Oil Company announced it would build a huge petrochemical refinery somewhere in that Appalachian region. The plant, known in the industry as a cracker, could bring billions of investment dollars and thousands of jobs. Mari Saito of member station WCPN reports.
In Wheeling, West Virginia, the Spartan headquarters for the Upper Ohio River Valley Trade Council was built in 1966, when the steel industry reigned supreme. But unemployment soared when the mills started shedding workers. Things are about to change, though, for Tom Gray, who sits in the council hall as the head of the 6,000-member affiliation of unions representing local construction workers. All anyone wants to know is where Shell might build an ethane cracker.
There's a tremendous work ethic in this valley. People like that, you know, they're struggling. There's a lot of displaced workers that could work right here if we can get this cracker.
A cracker is industry lingo for a plant that takes oil and gas and breaks them up into smaller molecules. An ethane cracker creates ethylene, a compound used in plastic. There's a lot more ethane in Appalachia these days, thanks to controversial drilling techniques known as fracking. Beverly Saylor is a geologist at Case Western Reserve University. She says it's been a while since companies looked to build new crackers in the U.S.
Plastic was made overseas, and that's because there wasn't enough natural gas. But now with all the shale gas development, the price has come down on that, and so it's now worth it.
Construction of a cracker facility could cost several billion dollars and employ as many as 10,000 construction workers at its peak. Once up and running, a world-class refinery could spread over several hundred acres and possibly employ up to 1,000 people. And that doesn't even count the jobs for likely spin-off businesses. It's enough to have state officials seeing stars. C. Allen Walker is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Community and Economic Development.
Potentially, it would be the biggest investment made in the Pittsburgh region in economic and industrial development since Andrew Carnegie built U.S. Steel, and we all know how long ago that was. I mean, it's a game changer.
Walker says a cracker would have a huge multiplier effect on jobs in the manufacturing and chemical industries. Ethylene is used in 90% of manufactured goods. Jack Pounds heads the Ohio Chemistry Technology Council and has worked to help bring the cracker to the Buckeye State.
This is a state that will have probably the most competitive global position in terms of raw materials for its chemical industry, and that should help reverse a couple of decades of decline in the industry in the state.
All three states have sent delegations to Shell to pitch locations for the ethane cracker. Details on tax incentive packages are still not being discussed publicly. Scoring the cracker would be a coup for any governor, especially when jobs are such a hot political issue. Keith Burdett is Commerce Secretary for the state of West Virginia. He says in the end, the ethane cracker will provide jobs all throughout Appalachia.
There'll be a lot of hooping and hollering, regardless of where it's picked, whether it's in West Virginia or Pennsylvania or Ohio. We want it built here. The truth of the matter is the sites, they're just so closely grouped together that the impact across state lines will be significant.
Shell is expected to announce its location for the ethane cracker any day now. State officials hope the cracker will take the Marcellus Shale's natural gas industry to the next level. One where gas and oil extracted from the ground can be processed and used by a new generation of businesses in Appalachia. For NPR News, I'm Mari Saito.
There's a new memoir out highlighting major changes in the Los Angeles Police Department. The first thing we should tell you about this book is it was not written by a cop. It's called Power Concedes Nothing, and it's written by civil rights attorney Connie Rice, who spent the last 20 years suing the LAPD. You want to know what the police thought of her book? NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates will tell you.
For two decades, civil rights lawyer Connie Rice was a thorn in the side of the Los Angeles Police Department. Actually, make that backside.
I woke up every day trying to figure out a new way to sue LAPD and the LA County Sheriffs because they were such a negative and humiliating and emasculating force in the black and brown communities.
So it's a little psychedelic to see her here in the belly of the LAPD's gleaming new police building where the police chief is hosting a book party for her. And cops, active, retired, uniformed, and plain clothes, are lining up for her to sign copies of her new book, Power Concedes Nothing. The book is Rice's account of how she and the department came to terms with each other in an effort to make L.A. safer and saner for all of its citizens.
How are you?
Good, how are you? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
As he welcomed everyone to Rice's party, Chief Charlie Beck admitted Rice and the LAPD had not always been friends. But he said their relationship has evolved into a solid partnership. The new police headquarters, with its open courtyards and big glass walls, is far friendlier than the old one. Beck told the crowd it's reflective of Rice's urging that the LAPD make itself more approachable to the community.
This is in part a house that Connie built.
There was a lot of chuckling over the irony. This prim, steely woman with her perpetually raised eyebrow has spent so much time suing her hosts in the past. But somewhere along the way, Connie Rice and the LAPD became friends.
I'm so biased at this point that I'm completely lost all my impartiality, and Chief Bratton achieved his goal. I can no longer sue the Los Angeles Police Department. But to tell you the truth, I don't want to. I don't need to.
When she began working at the Los Angeles office of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund in 1991, Rice ran into the old LAPD, the lean, mean policing machine Chief William Parker made famous in the 50s, and his hand-picked protege, Daryl Gates, made infamous in the 80s and 90s.
It was a very good paramilitary intimidation policing culture, but it was also racist.
Case in point, the 1992 riots sparked when four LAPD officers were acquitted of viciously beating black driver Rodney King. Rice believes the riots were a reaction to this kind of suppressive policing. Here, KNBC reports the chaos.
After 24 hours of seemingly unending violence in the city of Los Angeles, the toll of death and destruction is absolutely staggering. At least 17 people dead at last count, close to 500 injured.
After the 1992 riots, I think the curtain on our joint alienation, it rose just a bit.
Rice is sitting in the offices of the Advancement Project, a nonprofit she co-founded to address barriers to opportunity. Her windows in the Echo Park neighborhood have sweeping views of where poor, mostly immigrant L.A. meets hipster L.A. After the riots, Rice bluntly told city leaders what would happen if the city's poor neighborhoods continued to be ignored by its better-off residents.
Understand that if we leave these children trapped in these petri dishes from hell, where they can't learn, they're exposed to violence, they're forced into gangs, and the gangs run things. Guess what, ladies and gentlemen? That threat is going to come out of those communities like a cat out of a bag. At us.
That obligation to ensure the entire community's well-being was something that was drummed into Rice from birth. Her parents believed education would be a potent weapon in the fight for equality.
You learned three words by the time you were one and a half or two. The first one was mommy, second one was daddy, and the third word was college.
Philip and Anna Rice raised Connie and her brothers Norman and Philip Jr. throughout the U.S. and abroad. Colonel Philip Rice was one of the few black career officers in the United States Air Force. Anna supervised hours of homework and instilled proper behavior. The Rice parents, like a lot of their black middle-class peers, were rigorously preparing their children to excel in a world that often believed black excellence was an oxymoron.
It's not the tiger mom or tiger parent kind of thing. You're swathed and loved, you're cherished. The love is unconditional, but the expectations are also unconditional.
Those values run in the family. Connie's cousin, Condoleezza Rice, remembers being raised the same way.
We were just expected to succeed, and we were expected to work hard. And I remember my parents and their friends all had a saying, you have to be twice as good. And it was said as a matter of fact, not debate.
The cousins are about the same age, with the same quick minds and brisk speech. But the former Secretary of State says there is one major difference between them.
I'm not really actually quite as driven as Connie.
That's debatable, but Connie Rice is driven. Work seems to be her recreation, and she is relentless about bringing the LAPD and the communities it polices closer together for the entire city's benefit.
Part of the story of this book is that incredible journey of how we worked with a sued LAPD and then worked with them to get them to understand their interests were at a change. Their future in L.A. meant that they had to have the backing of these minority communities.
Both Rice and Police Chief Charlie Beck believed how the city was policed had to be changed. Beck and his predecessor, William Bratton, gradually replaced the old paramilitary hardliners with new commanders who had a more expansive view of what policing entailed. He says Rice worked hard to get key gang leaders to consider that the new method might save the youngest people in their communities and keep their mothers, wives, and girlfriends safe.
They want a police department that is fair, and they want a police department that's effective. Just being one or the other is not enough. You have to be both. And Connie has helped us to be seen as a police department that is fair.
Most of the time. It's not perfect. There are still police-community confrontations, but there seems to be more willingness to listen on both sides. Back down at the book party, Rice is working on other things that need fixing, even as she continues to sign books.
The MTA case, the 209 race, all that stuff.
And it's clear that while tonight was a celebration of Connie Rice and her book, it was also a celebration of the LAPD. It's a coming-out party of sorts for the department's rebirth as a 21st-century institution. And it's an acknowledgement that Rice, who Beck often calls the city's moral compass, has been critical to that effort. Karen Grigsby Bates, NPR News.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we want to tell you about some fresh new work coming out of the venerable Haitian art scene. There's an exhibition currently on display in the United States, but those who sponsored it hope to do more than sell some paintings. We'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. But first, we want to turn our attention to another one of those YouTube videos gone viral. After debuting last week, it has some 5 million views and counting, and it has created laughter and some controversy. It's a spoof of, and I'm going to use some edited language here because not everybody wants to hear about this. I'm going to say it's a riff off the comedy line, Stuff, My Dad Says, or Stuff, Girls Say. This one we will call Stuff, White Girls Say to Black Girls, and here's a clip.
Not to be racist, but...
Not to sound racist, but...
Not to sound racist.
My grandma hates collards. Wait, is that racist?
Why isn't there a white entertainment television?
The Jews were slaves too. You don't hear us complaining about it all the time.
Is it like... bad to do blackface? Is that still like a thing?
You can say the N-word, but I can't. How is that okay?
My best friend was black. I mean, she's still black, and we're not really friends anymore.
Oh my God, I'm practically black. Twinsies!
That's Francesca Ramsey. She is a 28-year-old graphic designer, comedian, and video blogger. She's had two YouTube channels where she posts her comedic skills and parodies, and she's with us now from our studios in New York. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been actually doing this for some time, haven't you?
For almost 5 years.
For almost 5 years.
I know.
And this one just took off.
I know. I mean, I think there are a few factors that made this one so popular. The other spoofs in the series have gotten really big. There's been an Asian take, a mom's take, a vegan's take, a yoga take. I mean, pretty much every facet has been covered. But I didn't see something that related to me. So I wanted to do something that I could identify with, but was a little different and maybe made people laugh, but made them think.
And just to give people a visual idea, you don a blonde wig in this video. It's really blonde.
Yes.
Is this based on someone or some people?
Well, the voice is actually based on a really good girlfriend of mine, and I hope, you know, she doesn't get a bad rap because she's really wonderful, and she's maybe only asked me about my hair like once. But a lot of the comments do come from my real life, whether it be people I've interacted with at work, college, school. I went to a predominantly white Catholic school growing up and had to encounter my fair share of awkward first moments with my friends.
Well, speaking of awkward, this is one of those things that has been a topic on this program before, which is hair.
Right,
the whole
of course.
Question of hair and, you know, friends and hair and what people are allowed to discuss with the hair. And there are some people who are going to listen to this and say, what, with the hair again? I don't want to hear any more about the hair.
Right.
But this is a big deal to some people.
Right.
And so I'm going to play a short clip, another from your series of videos of stuff white girls say to black girls. Here it is.
Can I touch it? Okay, I'm already touching it a little.
Is this real?
Is this all yours? Wait, it's not real? It is. It is. Okay, sorry.
So happy.
Kind of feels like a Brillo pad. Oh, did that hurt? Oh, sorry. Sorry.
You guys can do so much with your hair.
Kind of feels like Cheetos.
You know, we were watching this as a group. There are a bunch of us in our office, a diverse group, watching this in the office, and I'll just put it this way, that some people were just laughing out loud from the first word.
Right.
And then there were some, I can say it, red faces, I think. Some people were saying, I've said that to some people.
Exactly.
So tell me why this is funny and why do you think it evokes that response?
I think that it just depends on what side of the dialogue you're on. I chose to use the camera as kind of the POV of the black friend. So, you know, if it's something that you've experienced, it's like you're reliving the experience and laughing at how accurate it is. And if you have actually said that to someone else, it's kind of like you're stepping into my shoes for a minute just for this video. And suddenly you're thinking, oh, my goodness, how uncomfortable would it be to have someone just petting me like a dog? So I think it's funny because it's real and it's honest and it's silly when it happens to you. But I think it can be embarrassing for people to confront the fact that they might have crossed the line with some of their friends.
We're speaking with Francesca Ramsey. She is a blogger and comedian, and we're talking about her YouTube video that has gone viral, and we're calling it Stuff White Girls Say to Black Girls. Now, you know, there are people who think this is hilariously funny, but there are also people who think it's racist. This is racist. I think that's ludicrous.
I think the thing to remember is that, yes, this is based on my personal experience, but I also did it as a spoof of the meme Stuff Girls Say. So in that series, it's not some girls, it's just girls. And it's meant to be taken as a joke. It does not represent everyone the same way Stuff Black Girls Say does not represent everyone. So this is, you know, my take on that meme. But I think because it is a racially sensitive topic, people, when they don't understand, they're more quick to say, well, then that's racist because if a white girl was wearing an Afro wig, people would be really mad. And I don't think that it's not honestly meant to be offensive. It's in good fun. It's light spirited. The people that have said these things to me, I don't believe that they're racist. I believe that they maybe are just a little culturally sheltered. And that was my objective, was to make people laugh, but to make them double, like think a little bit and say, oh man, maybe I have done that. I shouldn't do that next time.
You know what's funny though? It's just, it seems to me that a lot of the cutting edge humor around race is on YouTube right now. You know, a lot of the network sitcoms, and I'm not going to mention any by name because, you know, who needs that?
Exactly.
But a lot of the network sitcoms have been criticized for being crude around race, about being stupid around race.
Absolutely.
And not just this season, but the past season or two. And yet the cutting edge, the humor that many people really find kind of fresh and appealing is on YouTube, and it's self-generated, although yours
right.
is, I just want to mention this for people who haven't seen it, is that the production quality, the editing is still pretty high. I mean,
thank you. I did all of it myself.
Well, congratulations. I'm just wondering
you.
Why you think that is.
I think that's for a few reasons, and I also think it's great that you brought that up because I think the way that race is presented on TV has kind of put us in this situation because for so many Caucasians, and not just Caucasian Americans, all backgrounds, a lot of times we gain our knowledge from TV, and so we say, oh, well, black girls on TV act like X, Y, and Z, but you don't. That's so weird. What is that about? So for me, at least, as an actress comedian, I have found that when I sometimes go on auditions or I get pitches for parts, I say, that's not me. And so that's what I try to do with my content online. I try to show who I am, but I try to show something that people will enjoy because they can relate to me.
Okay, one more question, Francesca.
Sure.
Can I touch your hair? Just kidding.
Sure. I will set up a little booth for you so you can teleport to New York and you can touch it all you want.
I was just kidding.
I know you were. I know.
Francesca.
But I'm still offended.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Francesca Ramsey is a video blogger and comedian. She joined us from our studios in New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You may wonder what all this means for that morning staple, Florida orange juice. Steve Newborn of member station WUSF in Tampa went to find out.
It's the afternoon rush hour at Bierce Groves, a green patch that has survived for more than a century in the spreading concrete sprawl just north of Tampa.
Have you ever had an edible orchid?
Brian Arnett and Elizabeth Leggett are filling their canvas tote bags with locally grown produce and citrus.
I love my oranges just the same. This is, as long as it's pulp-free, I'm happy about it. It's honey.
I get the from Florida anyway.
Yeah,
so.
If it's from Florida, that's what we drink.
Just behind the roadside fruit stand is a citrus packing and juicing house where fruit is sorted and fresh squeezed. Manager Ben Doster says this FDA testing will be a temporary blip in the public consciousness. He says the industry's faced health scares before, but they've always been short-lived.
I'm not too worried yet. I think it'll come and go. It'll ebb in and out.
This has caused a tremendous amount of volatility.
Bill Rafferty, an analyst at Pinson Futures in New York, says this week's news has caused orange juice futures prices to soar and then crash because the Brazilian fruit in question is often mixed with domestic oranges.
Market moved 20 cents yesterday, which is a huge move. A freeze would cause a move like this.
Citrus is big business in Florida. The state produces almost three-quarters of all citrus consumed in the U.S., and it's worth an estimated $9 billion to the Florida economy. So it's not surprising that growers are scared to talk about what's happening. Several declined to comment for the story, saying they didn't want to create unnecessary panic. Andrew Meadows with the Growers Association Florida Citrus Mutual says he's not surprised.
You know, it is frustrating for us. Our regulators, the FDA, has determined that this juice is 100% safe. You know, it's business as usual in our industry, and we're still producing a wholesome, healthy product.
The image of Florida's citrus industry has always been about health, sunshine, and green groves. But Meadows says it's an industry that's gotten smaller in recent years because of development gobbling up land, freezes, and other issues. And dealing with scares like this are just one of those challenges. For NPR News, I'm Steve Newborn in Tampa.